Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, More Than Meets the Eye, we bring you our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel reading. And Joan Knows, our resident Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, takes us back over the past week's events here in the Vatican. As usual, we begin today's broadcast with Jill Bevilacqua's programme, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus said to the crowd, "The reign of God is like a buried treasure which a man found in a field. He hid it again, and rejoicing at his find, went and sold all he had and bought that field. Or again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant's search for fine pearls. When he found one really valuable pearl, he went back and put up for sale all that he had and bought it."
The two parables in today's Gospel are told only by Matthew. Our version here introduces them by saying, "Jesus said to the crowd." Three other versions suggest that Jesus was speaking to his disciples alone. In the last two Sunday Gospels, we heard of Jesus telling the parable of the sower and that of the good and bad seed growing together. But before he explained the second parable to his disciples, we read that he left the crowds and went into the house. And elsewhere, "Then, having sent away the multitudes, he came into the house, and his disciples came to him." Whether he spoke these two short parables to the crowds, or only to his closest disciples, makes no difference to their meaning. A scholar comments,
"These two little parables have the same lesson. The kingdom of God is worth so much that everything is not too high a price to pay for it."
And Frank Sheed writes,
"The two tiny parables were a reminder of the vastness of what is at stake. Compared with that, all other successes are meaningless. Men will make the kingdom their own only if they're willing to sacrifice everything else for it." "If you wish to be perfect, go and sell what you own and give the money to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven."
For the rich young man, however, the price to pay was too high, and he went away sad, for he was a man of great wealth. But what of the parable? The reign of God is compared to a buried treasure, hidden in the other versions, but buried is somehow more powerful in its implications. How many fantastic tales have been written of treasure seekers, of men in pursuit of a dream of unearned riches?
The third of the tall trees rose nearly 200 feet into the air above a clump of underwood. A giant of a vegetable, with a red column as big as a cottage and a wide shadow around, which a company could have manoeuvred. But it was not its size that now impressed my companions. It was the knowledge that 700,000 pounds in gold lay somewhere buried below its spreading shadow. The thought of the money, as they drew nearer, swallowed up their terrors. Their eyes burned in their heads, their feet grew speedier and lighter, their whole soul was bound up in that fortune, that whole lifetime of extravagance and pleasure that lay waiting there for each of them.
Stevenson's Treasure Island, of course, the story of a hunt for treasure which has never been surpassed. But why did our Lord compare the kingdom of heaven to a buried treasure? A scholar attempts an explanation.
The treasure hidden in a field seems to allude to the habit of the ancients, when invading armies were approaching, of carefully placing their precious objects in specially made containers and hiding them underground. When the danger had passed, it was fairly easy to come across one of these hiding places and so to make one's fortune after having bought the land from the owner.
How often, then, was the person who hid the treasure unable to find it again? Like the squirrel who hides nuts for the dark days of winter but then forgets where the hiding place is. Coins and other valuables of gold or silver found in the ground or other place of concealment is known as treasure trove, from the old French word trove. Treasure trove, we read, belongs to the crown, but in practice the finder is usually given the market value of his find. One such find is thus reported in the Times of September the 25th, 1968. A noble mentioned here was a former English gold coin.
Mainly nobles, they're part of the fishpool hoard of 1,237 coins, which were found on a building site near Newstead Abbey in Nottinghamshire in March 1966. The hoard, which is described by the British Museum as the largest find of medieval gold coins so far recorded in England and of quite exceptional importance, was declared to be treasure trove by a coroner's jury.
But what do we actually mean by treasure? A dictionary defines it as wealth stored or accumulated, especially in the form of precious metals, gold or silver coin, hence generally money, riches, wealth. It could also be a store or stock of anything valuable, indeed anything valued and preserved as precious. It can even be used of a person, a jewel. As a quotation of 1810 has it, "My nurse, a treasure and the most respectable of dames." In our day, it would probably be applied to the precious commodity usually known as the cleaning lady. There are, of course, many different perceptions of treasure according to each individual's scale of values. In Shakespeare's Richard II, Mowbray, the Duke of Norfolk, gives his idea of it to the king.
The purest treasure mortal times afford is spotless reputation. That away men are but gilded loam or painted clay.
And writing in the 16th century, Nicholas Grimald declared,
"Of all the heavenly gifts that mortal men commend, what trusty treasure in the world can countervail a friend?"
A sentiment many of us would endorse. But perhaps a higher vision is that of Langland, the 14th century author of Piers Plowman, when he wrote that truth is treasure, the best tried on earth. From Robert Browning's Christmas Eve, written in 1850, come these lines, referring to the preacher he is listening to, but who has failed to impress him.
"For the preacher's merit or demerit, it were to be wished the flaws were fewer in the earthen vessel, holding treasure, which lies as safe in a golden ewer."
The reference to the earthen vessel we find first in St. Paul, writing his second letter to the Corinthians.
"What we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For it is the God who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' who has shone in our hearts, to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, to show that the transcendent power belongs to God and not to us."
So what is treasure then but Christ himself, the only true treasure, the only one worth seeking? Wrote Thomas A'Kempis in his Imitation of Christ.
He who finds Jesus finds a precious treasure. In fact, he finds a good better than all goods. And he who loses Jesus loses a very great thing, and loses more than if he had lost the whole world.
The last word on treasure is recorded by Matthew as part of the Sermon on the Mount.
Do not store up treasures for yourselves on earth, where moths and woodworms destroy them and thieves can break in and steal. But store up treasures for yourselves in heaven, where neither moth nor woodworms destroy them, and thieves cannot break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also.
And we come now to the merchant in search of fine pearls. And what is a pearl?
A small, dense, usually lustrous and often rounded mass of concentric layers of mother-of-pearl that is formed as an abnormal growth around a foreign particle, for example, a grain of sand, in the shell of some oysters, mussels and related animals, can occur in a variety of colours, but is typically milky white and is much used as a gem.
And from that inevitably prosaic description, let's listen to these delicate lines from Tennyson's Maud.
See what a lovely shell, small and pure as a pearl, lying close to my foot. Frail, but a work divine, made so fairly well with delicate spire and wall, how exquisitely minute, a miracle of design. What is it? A learned man could give it a clumsy name. Let him name it who can, the beauty would be the same. The tiny cell is forlorn, void of the little living will that made it stir on the shore. Did he stand at the diamond door of his house in a rainbow frill? Did he push, when he was uncurled, a golden foot or a fairy horn through his dim water world? Slight, to be crushed with the tap of my fingernail on the sand, small, but a work divine, frail, but a force to withstand year upon year the shock of cataract seas that snap the three-decker's oaken spine athwart the ledges of rock here on the Breton strand.
Another version of the origin of pearls is recorded by Dr. Brewer.
Dioscorides and Pliny mention the belief that pearls are formed by drops of rain falling into oyster shells while open, the raindrops thus received being hardened into pearls by some secretions of the animal. They're actually a secretion forming a coating and repeated so often that they attain considerable thickness, caused by the attempts of marine and freshwater mollusks to get rid of a foreign object, for example, a grain of sand or tiny parasitic worm.
That a pearl may be born in what we might call impurities does not diminish its splendour. Has a pearl less whiteness because of its birth, writes Thomas Moore. And St. Jerome, a pearl will shine in the midst of squalor, and a gem of the first water will sparkle in the mire. And from Shakespeare, rich honesty dwells like a miser, sir, in a poor house, as your pearl in your foul oyster. Pearls are not to be found just anywhere, but a group of islands off the Venezuelan coast were called by the early Spanish explorers the Pearl Islands because of the area's large pearl fisheries. And Dryden wrote,
"Errors like straws upon the surface flow. He who would search for pearls must dive below."
When I hear the word pearl, two memories come immediately to mind. The first is from childhood, a nursemaid called Pearl, a small, dark-haired woman, she was probably still a girl, who always wore a navy blue hat with a large hatpin stuck in on one side. She lived by the creed that cleanliness is next to godliness. Certainly she was spotlessly clean, but there was not a spark of humour in her whole being. The second memory is from student days, of a scene in a play by Jean Anouilh, with the English title Ring Round the Moon. Lady India, mistress of a rich old man, has fallen in love with a poor young one, for whom she says she is prepared to become poor. "His money is burning my fingers," she declares. "I shall give it all back, immediately, everything, except the pearls." Throughout the centuries, pearls have been celebrated and were the stuff of legend. In Horace's satires, we read that Clodius, son of Aesop the tragedian, drew a pearl of great value from his ear, melted it in vinegar, and drank to the health of Cecilia Metella. While of Cleopatra, it's said that she gave a banquet for Antony at Alexandria, the cost of which aroused his astonishment. When Antony expressed his surprise, she took a pearl eardrop and dissolved it in her drink in order to impress him even more. In our time, when Queen Elizabeth II opens Parliament, she wears the imperial state crown, in which there are four pearls said to have been worn by Elizabeth I as earrings. A tender comparison appears in these lines from Swinburne's Pelagius.
"The world has no such flowers in any land, and no such pearl in any gulf the sea, as any babe on any mother's knee."
But there is only one pearl of great price, and on the Feast of the Nativity, this Byzantine canon is sung at matins.
"Bethlehem hath opened Eden, come, let us behold, sweetness we have found once hidden, pearl of price untold, gifts of paradise all precious, stored within the cave refresh us."
And from this 5th century hymn by Romanos the Melodious, considered to be the greatest poet of the Byzantine Church, to a poem of our own time. Here now is The Bright Field by R.S. Thomas.
"I have seen the sun break through to illuminate a small field for a while, and gone my way and forgotten it. But that was the pearl of great price, the one field that had the treasure in it. I realize now that I must give all that I have to possess it. Life is not hurrying on to a receding future, nor hankering after an imagined past. It is the turning aside, like Moses, to the miracle of the lit bush, to a brightness that seemed as transitory as your youth once, but is the eternity that awaits you."
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that programme, and for the readings by Sean Patrick Lovett. And now, our friend and Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, who is EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief, takes us back over the past week's events here in the Vatican. Once again, for logistic reasons, we had to record our conversation via the telephone rather than face-to-face in our studio. Okay, Joan, so here we are once again. Let's start by going back to Sunday and the Pope's Angelus.
Right, you're right. It's still a kind of a quiet week with the Pope on a semi-relaxing working vacation, if you will. And as usual, his only public appearance was at the Angelus on Sunday. And after talking about the gospel of the day, which he always does at the Angelus, perhaps his important words were those that he spoke about the situation in Jerusalem. He appealed for moderation and dialogue after a surge of violence and killings at Jerusalem's Temple Mount, which, of course, is a holy site for both Jews and Muslims. The Holy Father said he was following with trepidation the grave tensions and violence of the last days in Jerusalem. And, of course, last week there had been shootings with two Israeli policemen dying and then 3 Palestinians killed in street clashes and so forth. And Pope Francis said, referring to all this, "I feel the need to express a heartfelt appeal for moderation and dialogue." He asked the Lord to inspire all sides to come together with proposals for reconciliation and peace. Then you had the tensions growing because there was an installation by the Israelis of metal detectors after the 2 policemen were killed earlier this month. This measure angered the Palestinians, who accused Israel of trying to take control of a sacred place, and actually Thursday Israel did remove those detectors. So then, looking at other news this week, we know it was a quiet week, so nothing papal or big Vatican news on Monday, but interestingly enough, Tuesday was fascinating, and it was kind of the news story that was heard around the world, because you and I know, a lot of our listeners may not, there's a huge drought affecting Italy and certainly affecting the city of Rome and the surrounding areas. And the Holy See, the Vatican, was one of the first to take measures to save water. The governorate of Vatican City State, and it's my understanding, and I actually heard it on Vatican Radio, that the Pope asked that the fountains of Vatican City, those in St. Peter's Square, and then the fountains in Vatican City, which most visitors might not see, he asked that those be turned off to save water. And this is so important because actually you and I and others who live here are looking at the possibility of water being rationed for alternate periods, alternate neighborhoods, but for like 8 hours a day. The interesting thing is, we spoke of the Vatican City fountains, but also fountains like the iconic Trevi Fountain, they risk running dry. Perhaps the most astonishing thing is that the drought has left rainfall totals 80% below the normal. And of course, we really have to worry about agriculture. At least 2 billion euros worth of damage have been done.
Yeah, coming back to the Vatican, I mean, apparently the Vatican spokesman, Greg Burke, he told some journalists that, as far as he understood, it was the first time that the authorities in the Vatican had turned off their fountains. And he said, of course, it's very much in line with the teachings of Pope Francis in his encyclical, yes, not wasting our precious resources. And also, for those of our listeners who are fond of statistics, I gather that the Vatican has no fewer than 100 fountains scattered about its territory.
Well, if you walk through the Vatican Gardens, I never thought of counting them, of course, but if you walk through the Vatican Gardens, there's, oh, the Fountain of the Eagle, huge, big, beautiful fountain, and then a lot of little smaller ones. The only ones I haven't seen in person to know if they're open or closed are the drinking water fountains that are under the right and left colonnades, where you just walk up and you hit the little spigot and then, or turn it on, and then water comes out. So I don't know if the drinking water fountains, I don't know from personal experience, if the drinking water fountains were turned off. So I guess I'll have to make a visit in coming days.
Yeah, I don't know that. Okay, let's move on to the other story, which of course has been going on for some time now, and that is this heartrending story of the little baby Charlie Gard.
Exactly. Well, you know, you have so many different countries involved in this issue, too, trying to keep the baby alive with this very unusual mitochondrial disease. And you had Pope Francis intervening with prayers, and not only just a few days ago, but in a month ago. You had officials from the Bambino Gesù Pediatric Hospital in Rome, you know, offering to bring the baby to Italy, the offer of a Vatican passport, the offer of President Trump offering U.S. residency and bring Charlie to the U.S. And so you have the Pope, you have the U.K. bishops, you have the presidency of the United States all kind of intervening. And just days ago, as a matter of fact, Monday evening, when it seemed that all really was lost for the parents who simply want to take their baby home. He's almost a year old. They simply want to take him home and have him die there. And it seems that the courts have said no, but
yes, apparently he's going to be going to a hospice. Actually, they're not revealing which hospice and the dates.
Oh, Right, but if you have a child, certainly, in the family, you know why the parents simply want to bring him, you know, home. He won't be living much longer. So, and the Pope, the Vatican did issue a statement Monday evening that said Pope Francis feels especially close to the Garrard family at this time of immense suffering. And, of course, he requested prayers for the faithful. And then, interestingly enough, regarding that day's decision by the parents of Charlie Garrard, the bishops of England and Wales, of course, expressed their deepest sympathy and compassion for them and their son. And the statement said in part, "It is some weeks now since Pope Francis said he was following with affection and emotion the case of little Charlie Garrard and expresses his own closeness to the parents. For them he prays, hoping their desire to accompany and care for their child to the end is not ignored." And another part of the message said that the parents' farewell to their tiny and precious baby touches the heart of all who, like Pope Francis, have followed this sad and complex story. And then, interestingly enough, of course, the bishops did not forget to thank those who'd been the caregivers for Charlie in all these many months since he's been in the hospital. And their statement said, "It's important to remember that all involved in these agonizing decisions have sought to act with integrity and for Charlie's good as they see it. The professionalism, love, and care for severely ill children consistently shown at the great hospital." They praised that professionalism and care. And, of course, that obviously was something some people that no one could or should forget over that long period of time that they cared for Charlie. So, and I think that many, many people are looking at court systems like, when do parents' rights begin and when do they end, if they end at all? So I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about that in the future as well.
I agree with you, Joan. Okay, let's move on to Wednesday.
Yeah, so Wednesday we had news of Cardinal George Pell, who is the prefect of the Secretariat for the Economy in the Vatican, and of course is Australian. He made a brief appearance at an Australian court in a preliminary hearing regarding accusations of what are known as historical sexual offenses. By historical, we're referring to a period of time, a lengthy time back in time. And though the cardinal did not speak in the courtroom, it was just a brief hearing, 6 minutes, his lawyer said quite clearly that Cardinal Pell would plead not guilty to the charges leveled against him by police in the state of Victoria and, quote, will maintain the presumed innocence that he has. He did announce at a press conference in June in the Vatican that he would be taking a leave of absence from his role as prefect of the Secretariat for the Economy for as long as he trial would require, and if I recall correctly, at the time he had the Holy Father's full backing to do this.
Okay, let's move on. There's just one message from the Pope, wasn't there, this week?
Yes, he did send a message to the International Meeting of the World Movement of Christian Workers to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the foundation of this movement. The theme was Land, Home, and Work for a Worthy Life. Pope Francis, in the message, stressed that the dignity of the person is closely united to these three realities. These remind us that the fundamental experience of the human being is to feel rooted in the world, in one family, in a society.
And I was speaking there to Joan Lewis, who's EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudator Jesus Christus.